got the thumbs up, so let's go. We're going to be a little different to kick things off today because we're looking at the analytics. Too many people drop off during watching the show before we get to the actual discussion. So I guess the people have spoken. You people didn't love my little skits enough. So something bad happened to Christian and you're involved in more crimes, blah, 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 fill in the blanks. We're moving on.
News. Hard-hitting news.
Hard-hitting news.
Nothing but the news.
Nothing but the news. That's all we're giving them. No sloth cam here.
No traffic reports.
No puddle getting smaller, local news coverage. The cherry blossom. Right now in D.C., the local news is all about the cherry blossoms are entering peak bloom, like countdown to their fullness. Like they're we're at 98% cherry blossom enrichment.
The Hawks are, getting ready to bomb the cherry blossoms.
I'm not going anywhere near the ones that are around the tidal basin or whatever. There are so many tourists there. You can't get within miles, and it's a real bad time if you don't want to be around other people.
Yeah, I've lived in D.C. for 9 years now, mm-hmm. and I've never gone down during the cherry blossom season because it's just so oversubscribed, right?
And because of your Sinophobia, your hatred of the Japanese?
That would be Chinese. Sino is Chinese.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so different countries, probably.
Yeah.
I don't know. What would be the term for anti-Japanese hatred?
The Japs.
Japophobia.
The Japs are out to get us.
That sounds like a little too racist term for describing Japanese racism.
So what's going on in the news? Bad week for flying. The TSA headache seems real bad. I'm going to Vegas tomorrow, which is why we're filming early. I'm worried.
And why we will be filming late next week.
Well, what happens in Vegas...
Well, stays in Vegas because of the TSA lines, yeah.
Because you can't get out. No, it's real bad out there. It's suffering, and
I'm seeing TSA lines of 3 hours long in some airports.
Congress
out to the...
should probably just vote to fund this thing and leave whatever other stupid fight they're doing for later.
I actually am kind of two minds because I don't have to fly anywhere.
You sick freak.
Yeah, just you wait for it. Yeah, yeah.
Two minds.
Both one dirtier than the last.
There's only two genders though.
Right. Well, of course. Right. Yeah. But you can keep thinking about them in more disgusting ways. But Yeah. So I kind of resent this idea of like, oh, Congress should just do its job and fund the agency. Because like government shutdowns, in a way, are Congress doing its job. They have reached an impasse over whether or not to give the executive more money to do this particular function because Congress has power of the purse. They're exercising it, in this case, to push for reforms at DHS, right? This is a piece of leverage that they have. It's unfortunate that this has impacts on the flying public because the federal government has also chosen to monopolize airport security with the exception of a couple airports and put it in the hands of the TSA, which everyone hates, which is then housed in DHS, which everyone also hates. So, but I don't just want to just like throw more money at the TSA to make this problem go away. We should just get rid of it, right?
We should absolutely abolish it. I mean, that's in the long term, in the immediate short term. The law says that there will be this level of security and you'll have to pay the people to do it. And people shouldn't have to work for free, even government employees.
Yeah,
so
that's
immediately
true.
We have to get them their money and have it go as business as usual. But mid to long term, we should abolish the entire thing. I keep saying this, every venue in the country uses security measures that are perfectly adequate.
Yep.
You go to the courthouse to get, whatever, traffic ticket or allegedly killing, murdering, raping people, alleged. You're just a suspect.
Alleged.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You got to go
called
through
due process.
It's a little thing called due process. You got to go through security and that's fine. But what you don't do is take off your shoes. What you don't do is have a water bottle of only this size.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go through your underwear. They don't take a naked photo of you. They don't feel you up. They don't...
Right. The building where people accused of killing people go to, you just walk through a metal detector.
Lenient, right.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Anyone trying to get onto a flight.
None of this is necessary to make flights safe. We're all having... This is 9/11, reaction. We couldn't... I don't know how else to say this. You couldn't hijack a plane anymore. Couldn't be done. The pilots are behind... reinforced concrete doors that's sealed that you can't open. They will not open them. That was a good idea. That was the single good security innovation to come out of 9/11. All right, we'll trap the pilots in there. That's that. Cannot be hijacked anymore. The reason planes used to be hijacked was that nobody thought to crash a plane into a building. They would be hijacked throughout the 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. and the plane would be flown to Cuba to right. visit Hassan Piker and Ryan Grimm and everybody.
Nathan Robinson.
Yeah. Because there was just activists going to Cuba. They'd get off the plane. The Cuban government would take them prisoner and probably torture them, mm-hmm. and the plane would go back. I read, actually—
Because of our embargo, the Cuban government was forced to torture the activists.
Right. Right. It's our fault. We considered building a fake Havana Airport in Florida make it like, oh yeah, we're landing in Havana now, because it wasn't for terrorism. And then a little person named Osama bin Laden ruined that for everybody.
Terrible.
And
well,
now
okay,
we do all
you're skipping a little bit of the story, because in response to hijackings, which were getting kind of out of control in the 1970s, right? The airports and airlines did implement more security. That's when you get the metal detectors.
Right. Some security
screening.
Is fine.
You know what? You want to x-ray the bag? Okay, fair enough.
Fine.
You want to go through metal detector? That's fine.
Let's just, instead of disarming everyone or making sure we disarm the bad guys, why don't we arm everyone on the plane?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what stops a bad guy trying to hijack a plane?
A good guy trying to hijack a plane. Yeah. Because if, some percentage of people are going to want to divert the plane into Cuba or some sort of terroristic attack. But if the hijacker just wants to get to Minneapolis on time,
then
that's actually more efficient, right?
I was hijacking a plane to stop a different hijacking.
Right.
Yeah. So this is all nuts. Also, nobody likes when you say this, but it is true. You can establish, you can build a rudimentary explosive device from just items you can purchase in the airport once you're already through airport security.
Really?
You can they
describe for our listeners how you would do this.
They sell little lighters. Mm-hmm. They sell alcohol.
Ooh.
So little Molotov cocktail action. Are you going to successfully hijack the plane with that? No. But also, the guy who had the bomb in his shoe or whatever, it was not going to successfully.
The underwear bomber.
Anyway.
He'd set off the underwear bomb, but it only just burned him.
Right. It burned his genitals.
Yeah. That seems like a,
good riddance. So we don't need to do this because of some terrorist singed genitals, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we do, and the solution is to abolish it.
You know, air travel is a modern miracle, and it's gotten so much better with the rise of technology, too. You can jet across the country for a few hundred dollars across this giant continent. You can get to your destination in a couple hours, right? Everything, and while you're doing it, you're connected to the wider world. You can watch endless entertainment, take a nap, read a book, whatever you want to do. The seats are a little smaller than a train, but other than that,
read a book. Okay, great, I'll just get right on that Poindexter. I was perusing the encyclopedia.
I'm just saying it's an option. Obviously, no one would take it. Yeah, that would be suspicious.
Yeah.
That's what TSA should be looking for. Oh, what do you got here?
I was just going to be reading the Quran on my little travels.
What sucks about air travel, though, it is the security. That's the one thing that sucks about it, right?
Yeah.
You want to take a train, you just get on the train. There's no metal detector.
I know, and I bring this up as a counterpoint every time, but I also know, that's just because they haven't thought about it hard enough. I worry about screaming that counterexample too loudly because eventually someone in authority will go, we should have TSA-style security for the train too.
Mm.
Don't you know?
Yeah. I'm wondering if it's...
Because the train is crazy. There's no security of any kind. You don't have to line up ahead of time. You can jump on that thing as it's pulling away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you
don't
can't,
have to have a ticket, nothing. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. You can't drive a train into a building. You can just derail a train, but...
Yeah, which would be pretty bad.
It would be bad. And you can't... I don't know how you would even go...
Yeah. I am wondering if the government, they don't have TSA for Amtrak or whatever, because it would be the government losing money if they have TSA for that, right?
Yeah.
Whereas, they don't care if the airlines, lose money to people not flying because they hate security, right?
I've been in deplorable states on the Amtrak coming back from New York. You know, I used to do more hits for Fox News or CNN, et cetera, from New York. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'd be coming back late at night.
Oh, no.
You know, you're coming back 3 hours on that train. I mean, compared to what I would do on a plane. Even if I'm flying overnight on a plane, I think I'm generally pretty put together looking. You know, you can look nice in athletic wear, whatever. Mm-hmm. People take their shoes off. You know, we've debated that before. But on the train, for some reason, I'm like, if I'm training back from like midnight to 3 a.m., I'm changing into sweatpants. I'm buying a bottle of wine. I'm just like lounging out. I'm turning it into my bedroom. I'm getting trashed. I remember one time that the train, it didn't derail, but there was some problem with it. We had to switch trains. And I'm like,
oh no.
I'm in like gym shorts and I've got my suitcase. I've got a bottle of wine. I'm like staggering onto another train with a half open bottle of wine. Anything goes.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
Anything goes.
The first time I ever took an Amtrak, I get on in Washington, D.C., going to Richmond, Virginia. And I sit next to a man who is drinking a large 20-ounce Coors Light. He offers me one, which I, you know, gladly accept. And I say, you got a lot of those. He's like, oh, I've been drinking them since New York.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a train, baby.
It's the train. Yeah. You can do whatever you want. Yeah. There is a certain freedom on the train. And we could have that on the airplane too.
We could.
You know?
But, we could.
Alas.
You used to have to do with the Amtrak before they had assigned seating because of COVID. There was some awkward, because everybody wants a seat to themselves, but nobody knows how full the train is because you can't really tell if, like, that car's full. So then it's like, when do I settle? I'm like, sorry, sir, I know you have your backpack there, but I got to sit here. And be like, well, there's probably more – you know, no. That was kind of a mess. So I prefer the assigned seating.
Hmm. Yeah, sure.
That's the one thing.
Well, they're getting rid of the free seating for even the airlines. Southwest.
Free seating on airlines sounds insane to me. That's what Southwest does,
yeah.
That.
Mm-hmm. No one likes that. Yeah.
I don't ever fly Southwest. It sounds very weird.
Miserable. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I hope Congress, you know, does their – fucking job, and gets this agency that they have tasked with, you know, being this deliberate hurdle, slowing down the process of flying, get them their money and then move to do something. Obviously, the broader fight is about DHS funding and the ICE policies and all of that. Our Congress is just, it's broken, but the impact of that is that they're very reluctant to approve funding. But all these things, this isn't like, when it's not getting funded, it's not like the government is shut down.
No,
like,
we don't have real shutdowns anymore.
It's not a real shutdown. Mm-hmm. So it's not, and also it's not the things you want to get shut down necessarily getting shut down. It's not, from a liberty maximizing standpoint, it is not anything, in my view, to be particularly excited about, right?
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, the TSA is a great example. The government rules and restrictions don't go away.
Right.
The government simply ceases to provide
I still
provide
have to pay
them.
My taxes.
Yep, still got to pay your taxes. So much of the government is already considered essential workers, so they're already working. And so they're not going to be affected by the shutdown. So many more of them are going to end up working for free, right? All the workers who are furloughed, it's basically just like a paid vacation that they get paid later for, right? You stay home for a few weeks, and then when you come back, you get a paycheck for all the days that you didn't work, right?
It's an inefficiency because, they're going to get paid. They're going to get back pay even if they weren't working,
right?
Even if they were furloughed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're paying them to not work in the long run.
Yeah.
They're not working and they'll be paid for the time they're not working.
Yeah.
So that's the opposite of what we want.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well,
I mean, we want them working and paid or not working and not paid, not working and paid.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if there's some, like, they're not working and therefore people feel comfortable flouting enforcement of rules we don't want, but I don't know how much that actually happens.
That really happens.
So, yeah, there's really no upside to this, even though the term government shutdown sounds good.
It sounds good.
It sounds good. It's what we want.
It sounds good, but it's a little...
Yeah, it's more like you're putting the government on mute, you know?
Yeah.
That's what you're doing. You pressed the mute button. You haven't turned the TV off, right? That's where we're at. Yeah.
Yeah. I always put on subtitles.
Yeah?
Captions.
Captions, yeah. I do as well.
Even for things in English, obviously.
I
can't understand what the TV's saying anymore. Is that just because I'm an old man? Or is it just everything you're wearing my phone now?
I was about to say, oh, it's not because you're an old man. I have the same problem.
No, dialogue is too muffled in entertainment now. It's too gray and dark. It's too hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
It's too hard to see and it's too hard to hear. It's the only important things to get right, and they can't do it anymore.
Nope. Yeah, that's why the captions, at least they have little helpful descriptions of what's happening on the screen as well. Yeah. See, you're halfway to reading a book already.
Such a chore now. Maybe you gotta learn to read. What else we got? Oh, I wanted to ask you about the streetcar.
Yes, DC streetcar.
A streetcar named Retire.
Oh, very good.
You like that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it's being retired.
Yes.
Yeah. Speaking of old man things, yeah.
Tell us about it.
Okay, sure. So Washington, D.C. For
had the
next
stupidest form of transportation known to man.
Truly, truly.
Right.
So in 2016, very late and very over budget, they open the DC streetcar, which goes almost to a metro stop at Union Station, along H Street, almost to a metro stop on the other side of H Street, slower than the bus that already travels down this street, and oftentimes slower than walking. I have lived in D.C. for 9, 10-ish years. Basically, the entire time I've lived in D.C. has been the time that the streetcar has been up and running. And I've ridden it maybe once.
I've never been in.
Definitely once.
I've seen it. I used to live on H Street, this area.
The only place it runs.
The only place it is available. It is available on one street in the city.
Yeah.
And I used to live there, and I would go up and down that street. This street has a number of... There's the grocery store. There's a number of restaurants.
Yeah, it's a nightlife district.
It's a nightlife-y. It's up and coming. You know, it's nice. Well, it's not nice. It's nice. It's not nice. It's fighting gentrifications.
It's degentrifying now.
It's degentrifying. Yeah, I don't live there anymore. Right. That's where that one Rand Paul staffer got really
stabbed.
Horrifically attacked.
Yeah, by a guy who got out of prison the day before. Right. Yeah. Probably should have just left him there.
Probably.
Yeah, now he's back there. But anyway, go on.
That was on 8th Street. Yeah. So this is a... You know, this isn't like you kind of walk here looking for some place to drink or eat or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really my point being the streetcar isn't like ferrying you across some very essential part of the city where you're here and you want to be here.
Yep.
Like you might want to be many places in the middle here.
Right. Yeah, but even then it doesn't do a good job. I remember a couple months ago I was almost going to take the streetcar because I needed to go from Union Station to halfway down H Street. This is the one trip the streetcar can perform. And it was still – I take the 10 minutes to walk from Union Station to the streetcar platform, which is like weirdly on an overpass that's hard to get to, and it's not clear how to even get there. You have to know where you're going.
It's very weird.
I get there, I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'll wait for the streetcar. But then I realize I can see everywhere the streetcar is going and has been. And I look down the tracks and I see no streetcar. I'm like, dang it, it's just going to be faster to walk. And so that's what I ended up doing. So, but anyway, so this, the streetcar came to life as part of. There was a kind of Obama-era streetcar revival. After the Great Recession, we're going to spend a lot of federal dollars.
Whose streets? Our streets.
That's right. Hands up, don't shoot.
Yeah.
You got to say that sometimes on the streetcar.
Yeah.
But, certainly on H Street. But the Obama administration put a lot of money into streetcars, not really as a transportation method and not actually as into the DC streetcar, but
shovel ready.
So yes, it was shovel ready jobs and it was, I do, and domestic manufacturing because we were going to make all these streetcars right here in America, specifically in Portland, Oregon, right? So a bunch of, federal grant programs are rewritten to prioritize livability and economic development as opposed to moving people. Federal government doles out all this money to, streetcar projects across the country. DC's had been an ongoing concern, so it doesn't get a lot of this money. And they build them and they're all complete disasters with low ridership. Basically all of them have to stay fare free because then otherwise ridership would literally drop to zero. This was the case with the DC streetcar. They were initially going to have fares and have a big network, but then they realized that if no one is going to pay for this whatsoever, and so it would be so embarrassing to charge fares and maybe wouldn't even be worth the cost of collecting them, that we're just going to leave it for free. And even if you go back and read the press coverage from when the streetcar first opened in 2016, everyone thought it was a joke then, right?
And they were right.
And they were correct. But it's lumbered on, as I said in my newsletter this week, you know, it feels like kind of like beating a dead horse to criticize the streetcar, although the dead horse would probably get you where you're going faster.
Yeah,
but it's lumbered on for 10 years, and then eventually the city decided to cut its budget for operations, and it'll close March 31st. And so if you're in D.C. and you want one last ride, get it while you can.
The other fascinating thing about it is that it was absurdly dangerous, not because it's hitting people or running people over, but because the track for it is, I can't even tell you how scary. It's this strip in the ground that is the perfect width to ensnare scooter and biker wheels, and people wipe out constantly because you have to cross it at a very perpendicular angle. If you cross it at all, like on a diagonal, your wheel will go into it, lock, and you will fall off your bike.
Someone was killed this way.
We're not joking around.
Their wheels locked in the track, and they fell in front of the streetcar, and the streetcar ran them over. Yeah,
not good.
Yeah.
These shovel-ready projects.
Maybe it was another vehicle that ran them over.
I think they hit another vehicle. Okay. I don't think they hit the streetcar.
But it was the tracks that tripped them up. Yes.
They hit another vehicle. Yeah. These kinds of projects used to be controversial, like during the Obama era, because a waste of money.
Yeah.
I think now they would be controversial because they're giving jobs to, like, it's the Asian and Indian people who are planning the project, and then
racism.
People
that's
are the
why
ones
we
doing
like
it.
Them.
Why are we giving jobs to foreigner labor? Right? That would be the outrage.
Yeah,
not that the government's spending money your money on things that are stupid. But.
Right. So we should be building a streetcar for heritage Americans.
Right. The heritage streetcar.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Maybe it just goes to the Heritage Foundation.
To the Kirby Center across the street. Yeah, they should be building a streetcar from AEI to the Heritage. Go from left to right. Yeah.
Yeah, those people wouldn't want to talk to each other anymore.
That's true.
Heritage is just like Claremont now, because all the people who left Heritage, they went to Mike Pence's organization. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, Advancing American Freedom or something like that.
Yeah. It's funny.
But no, so we're out of. It was funny. One of the local news outlets wrote about they like tried to gin up some sort of like nostalgia and despair for the closing of the streetcar. They're like interviewed like 8 street commuters about what they're gonna do after the streetcar closes, and everyone was just like, I guess I'll take the bus because it goes the exact same place but faster.
It's like the we were talking about the Onion news network, the old Onion videos that are so hilarious. The one where they're talking about, do you remember life before the Segway? What a life changing invention. do you remember the Segway drive-in movie or the first time you had sex on a Segway?
Okay, maybe the Segway actually is a good example of like an idea that was just like, it was before its time, right? Because now micro-mobility, scooters and the like, pretty popular, right?
But the scooter doesn't use Segway technology. There's that like giant wheel with a skateboard on top of it.
Oh yeah, sure. Use. The one wheel
is that using Segway technology?
What is the technological innovation of the Segway?
I was really counting on you to know that. No, it's some kind of
like balance physics, gyroscope.
Like I don't know what it's doing. Yeah. It's doing something.
Okay, yeah, that's yeah.
No. It's doing something from a physics class standpoint. And I know this because in 11th grade at my high school, I was in honors physics. I was originally in AP physics, and I dropped that down to a less taxing physics class.
Is less than AP?
Oh, yeah. I'm not a math science guy. Okay.
I was in dishonorable physics. It's even worse than standard physics.
Yeah. I shall get you with this torque while you're not looking. Oh, you thought you had momentum. Aha! I don't know. But we had my teacher, who was wonderful, she got a Segway demonstration guy to come in and show us how a Segway worked, because it pertained to whatever physics equation we were learning at the time. It's not just, like the scooter, you're pressing go and brake.
Okay, yeah.
The Segway, you lean, and the action of the leaning is what's causing the motion forward.
Oh, okay.
So it's not, you're not pressing go on it.
Yeah.
That's what's different from a scooter to a Segway.
The one wheel thing,
I think it's your leaning that does it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you lean forward.
Which seems and I see people doing this, and I don't know how they don't die immediately, but.
I saw.
Maybe they do. this old guy with a giant, like, Santa Claus or God depictions beard and in like a hippie costume on one of these things, sunglasses. I remember thinking that that's a character.
Yeah.
That's a look.
I saw a guy and I assume his girlfriend riding a one wheel together. Not the one where you balance on it like a skateboard, but the one where you you put your feet on either side of the large wheel.
Oh,
you know
yeah,
what I'm talking
yeah, yes,
about?
Yes.
Yeah. And so he was.
What was the girlfriend doing?
She was like face like wrapped around him, facing him while he navigated the wheel.
Yeah, just out there having sex.
You know, young love.
Oh, good for them. Yeah.
That's the only wheel for him. You know.
We've doubled up on scooters. Before I've done that.
Yeah.
Not we. By
not
we,
not
I mean,
us.
Me
not
and
yeah. No. You have your scooter. I walk heterosexually to wherever I'm going.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I don't even like to be in an Uber with another man. That's why I always request the woman driver option now. So.
Oh my God, they don't have that option, do they?
No. But that, well,
I don't think people would.
They're considering rolling it out as like an anti
woman.
Anti. Wow. All right.
Well, they added an option to let a pet option.
Oh.
It's more like if you want, you know, if you're going to the vet and you don't have a car,
you can bring your pet with you.
Well, before it was ambiguous because you kind of could. Back when I had those little dogs, you know, had to take them somewhere before I had a car. I would kind of, you'd request an Uber, and then I would, like, message the person and go, by the way, bringing a dog, hope that's okay, and I don't know how else to handle it. Now it's explicit.
Okay, well, I guess that's better.
Yeah.
You didn't just do the legal hack where you're like, these are my ESAs, and it is against federal civil rights law you to not.
I hate those people. We're trying to take a peacock on an airplane. No reason the TSA is so backed up. They're trying to process so many zoo animals. Through the, oh, that's your emotional support, spotted leopard.
It's not Noah's Ark here, guys.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, I have commies in Cuba.
Yeah, what did you make of the so there was a delegation of leftist media figures and influencers who went down to Cuba.
Hassan Piker.
Yes, the workers' paradise of Cuba, where all their ideas about government have been implemented.
Yes,
and it is strangely enough now falling apart because of a lack of connection with global international trade and free markets.
I mean, I will say this though, you know, we are embargoing them harder than ever. And that's part of the reason for the.
So now they're having widespread blackouts and.
And I don't know that that's a good idea. Not that I don't want to be a panican. I don't want to, you know, trust the process. Whatever Trump does, you know, God is good.
Yeah.
His holiness. But we've been trying to.
Embargo Cuba for forever.
For like 80 years.
Yeah.
And it hasn't worked.
And the communists are still in charge.
Right.
Yeah. I guess this is one of those nice issues where both people are wrong.
Yeah.
On the one hand, the embargo has been proven wrong in that its goal is to overthrow,
dislodge
the communist regime. And it hasn't done that. And it continues to not do that, right? The communists are in control and will continue to stay in control for...
The people are suffering, the communists are in control.
And this is what sanctions do all the time. So the right-wingers are wrong about that. On the flip side, it is kind of nice to watch these leftists go down there and be like, wow, without trade and capitalism, you know, everyone is suffering down here. There's no customers. There's no tourists. How horrible is this?
Correct.
This has been Nathan Robinson's defense of his trip to this authoritarian regime, which, again, like I think it's perfectly fine to go, you know, to Cuba or China or wherever else. If someone wants to invite you, go and then have your own perspective.
The right-wing party of Germany, you know, some would call them Nazis, others call them other things. You know,
I'm a journalist.
Yeah, they invite you, you go.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
His defense.
You're photographed at certain rallies, you know, you're just there in a journalism capacity.
Yeah.
Right.
I was pointing at something. Everyone else maybe was doing some sort of salute, but
yeah. Well, God forbid you raise your arm.
Yeah, God forbid you point out an airplane in the sky. Yeah. His defense, Nathan Robinson from Current Affairs, his defense of his trip down there has been like, well, they badly need customers. You know, it's like Okay.
Because capitalism is good.
Yeah, capitalism is good and trade is good. Yeah. Yeah, so I feel like the embargo, it doesn't work for the right-wingers' purposes, but it does prove communism wrong. Because it's like, for your communist experiment to even work, you need to be a trading partner with the capitalist U.S., which and under your definition of leftism is doing nothing but exploiting you, but yet somehow it is also making you better off. How curious, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that I appreciated, but I don't know. Do you have additional thoughts you wanted to add?
No, not really. Just what you said.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it is weird how like there's certain no-go zones, right? If you're a journalist. So like Milton Friedman would bring this up when sometimes his he visited during Chile, South American country, there's a coup against the communists.
Salvador Allende?
Yeah, Salvador Allende. Socialist communist leader who was elected, violently overthrown. Not a good guy, but nevertheless, there was a coup that then installs a military dictatorship under Augusto Pinochet. Yes. One of the universities in Chile has a connection with the University of Chicago, where Milton Friedman is a professor. After the coup, he goes down there as part of their like exchange program, and he meets with Pinochet while he's down there, and he tells him like, "Hey, your economy's in free fall. Do free markets, and it'll be better." Pinochet then goes and does free markets, and lo and behold, Chile is the richest country in South America today. Right? Doesn't justify the dictatorship. Milton Friedman was not a fan of the dictatorship whatsoever. But people criticize him as saying, oh, you just like, you know, the Naomi Kleins of the world are like, you just love authoritarian governments because they'll, implement your version of free markets. And Milton Friedman brings up all the time. He's like, I went to China. I went to Yugoslavia. I went to any authoritarian government you can care to name and told them free markets are good. People just think I'm a Chilean dictator shill because they actually listened, right?
Right.
And so it's weird to me that it's like, oh, it's so horrible and wrong that, some lefty journalists would go to communist Cuba. But then, you know, how many newspapers have bureaus in China or, you know, wherever else, right?
Well, Hassan Piker visited China
and said
that its government is closest to his ideal form.
Right.
Like, the Chinese government is the most evil
organization
currently in existence.
Yeah, for sure.
I can very easily state that.
So
if you idolize this, you're just idolizing some... There is no worse thing to idolize. I don't know what to say. It's responsible for more global suffering than any other organization of people.
Yeah, they are the villains
of
the 21st century.
There's the villains.
For sure. Yeah.
But now you have – and all these right-wing, like, anti-interventionist people are getting taken in by CCP propaganda. You know, do you know this Professor Jiang guy? Did I bring him up last week? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Professor Jiang. Oh, he's the new hot thing for like Tucker interviewed him, Breaking Points interviewed him.
Okay.
And what's appealing about him, I guess, is he speaks in broken English and says absolutely moronic things about how everything the U.S. does is bad and we need a multipolar world run by China. I'm like, interesting.
Yeah.
And you know, Tucker says, oh, wow. So insightful. So what you're saying is the Western imperialists are lying?
Yeah.
That's correct, Tucker. Oh, wow. I can't believe I can't – no one ever talks about this in America.
Oh, right.
You're not allowed to say it. You're not.
And if you do, you go to prison.
Making fun of him a little bit. I like the guy personally, and I agree with that a lot of these wars are bad ideas. But you have to be able to separate the correct – war skepticism.
Yes.
And the just unhinged kind of validating of every crazy person. And this exists. This tension exists within the person of Joe Kent, this guy who resigned from the administration,
mm-hmm.
who has, I think, correctly called out that we've been too deferential to Israel's government and the intelligence claims they've made versus our own security, too led into this by them. All reasonable claims. Then... when he's asked about Charlie Kirk's assassination, then it's just asking questions. I don't know. They didn't let me investigate it. And could Israel be involved? Who can say? I don't know. Maybe. Well, it's not a crime to ask that question. It's like if you know something, just say something.
Right.
If you don't know anything, shut up. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear speculation about something that is already – decisively demonstrated, and they're like, well, what are you saying? No one should investigate? It's been investigated. They apprehended someone who confessed to his family and whose fingerprints are over the gun that was used to kill him. Yeah. So I'm not asking questions. Like, questions were answered by the forensic evidence. So if you have – now, that doesn't mean couldn't be some crazy other thing going on, but you can't just say, well, how do you know there isn't something else going on? You got to show me some evidence of that. I'm getting very annoyed of having –
it's like the burden of proof shifts.
Yes. I'm annoyed about having – being expected to disprove claims that are submitted in the first place without evidence. The burden is on you.
Yeah.
Someone saying something out of the ordinary – to demonstrate, that's an Ayn Rand quote, I think. Mm. I don't have to prove a negative. Mm. You have to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was arguing against all sorts of like supernatural phenomenon and whatever.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is Candace Owens shtick with Bridget McCrone or whatever else is. I'm just going to keep inventing lies about you,
right.
And now it's weird that you haven't taken the effort to disprove every insane thing that I've said about you.
Well, how do you know it's not true?
Right,
like, that's not fair.
And this just turns your brain into soup if you go down this road.
Yeah,
there's a couple. I mean, foreign policy is a good example of this kind of issue. A lot of the COVID stuff as well.
Yeah,
where the mainstream consensus and the mainstream media discourse about that consensus is so wrong that if you become a critic, you're ostracized from the mainstream, but then you find yourself in the company of kooks and grifters,
right?
And it's very easy to go from a respectable, correct critic of a very wrong mainstream consensus into all sorts of other kookery.
You end up on an island totally by yourself. And then again, the mainstream people will then say kooky stuff. I'm listening to Lindsey Graham talk to Bill O'Reilly, and Lindsey Graham is denouncing Joe Kent. And he's like, well, he's just an anti-Semite, and yeah, he wrote this letter that's just anti-Semitic. I'm like, oh, okay, nowhere in the letter does it refer to the Jewish people. It just refers to the government of Israel. So already, now you're doing this thing where criticism of the Israeli government is just anti-Semitism, which that's itself misinformation or a kind of misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't – a lot of the people attacking the Joe Kent side are not interrogating him in a fair or coherent way, which makes me not want to be associated with them.
Yeah.
But also I don't want to be associated with Candace Owens' side. I can't be on Candace Owens' side. So the other side has to do better. Or this side has to throw out Candace Owens, and I can be part of their side. Or this side has to just be a lot more responsible.
Right.
Both sides need to be more responsible. But I guess they're whatever. It doesn't reward that.
Or I mean, this is why you should be a libertarian.
Well,
right?
This is why I have no side, and I'm a libertarian, and we have no influence and power, and we're on an island by ourselves. But God damn it, I'm with the people I like.
There we go.
You, the other people out there. It's a movement of 17 people, and I'm perfectly happy with that.
There's only 10 true libertarians in the world, and 12 of them work here.
Yeah,
at Reason,
so. Exactly. That's basically true. That's basically true.
Well, it's just like, okay, if you correctly think the U.S. government foreign policy is terrible and people lie all the time and spread misinformation and, you know, deceiving framing to push the particular foreign policy agenda, you should assume the same thing is happening of, like, literal dictatorships as well, right?
Right. That's the lefty problem.
Yes.
Lefties are always saying, you know, raising valid points about we shouldn't believe the propaganda of the U.S.
But then they're
War Department.
Immediately hoodwinked by some other dictatorship.
Exactly. And by literal terrorist groups.
Right. The only way you can do that in an intellectually consistent way is you have to go full tanky, right? You have to believe that, you know, the U.S. is the pole, you know, the center of the universe for the capitalist domination.
Right.
And so anyone that's opposing the U.S. is on your side, even if they themselves are terrible terrorists or authoritarians who have no interest in communism whatsoever. You know, I've known some tankies, and that is their legitimate.
There's a coherence.
Yeah, there's a it's not legitimate. It's coherent, right?
Right.
They're like the revolution in America first, and then the rest of the world will fall. Right? Okay, I appreciate that. You're just telling me like Bashar al-Assad is good because he is at least standing up to the terrible evil that is America, right?
Yeah, the poison.
Yeah. Of course, then all these people still nevertheless end up just like repeating obvious propaganda. But, you know, there's an intellectual coherence there. This idea of like I'm opposing the authoritarianism of the American government as is this CCP, you know, professor is ludicrous, though. I'm opposed to the censorship of tech companies.
Yeah, yeah.
Unlike
yeah,
in
right.
China.
Yeah, oh, yeah. 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 What about show. Free speech? Yeah, okay.
Right. Yeah. Try to open run Current Affairs from Havana, you know, Nathan Robinson, right?
Well, it would be just as profitable there. I mean, you know what? He puts a lot of effort into it. It's a nice magazine. I enjoy reading his thoughts on why being a manatee is the ideal form of government.
Absolutely. I'm picking on him, but he's of all the lefty magazines, I appreciate Current Affairs more than most. There's a little dash and whimsy there. It's the one
whimsy.
It's the one leftist magazine that doesn't hear the phrase Iron Curtain and think it's fashion advice.
Yeah. Yeah. What else we got here? Spring weather.
Oh, okay. Oh, no. Yeah. We've been upset about this. Yeah.
Everyone's upset about this. One day it's cold. It's like pick a lane.
This is the thing is there actually is no spring weather. It's just summer and winter happening simultaneously.
Wow, you never hear this in the Western media. They would never dare talk about this. You're saying there's no spring weather?
That's right, Tucker.
The elites don't want you to hear that. I mean, of course it's true, but you can't say it.
Why?
Like, you literally can't say it.
and when you talk to other journalists about this, they're uninterested in that fact. Yeah.
We could do a really good show like this.
I hate it. I mean, DC is particularly temperamental when it comes
to
spring
weather.
We want
it hot and muggy.
Yeah, let's turn up the heat. Let's turn up the heat.
Make it sweaty, steamy.
You know what? There's some of those in DC, and these are in other cities too. The like white collar beggars, the people who stand out there for Save the Children or some other, you know, Amnesty International or whatever fundraising, you know, trying to stop you, waylay you so that you give a donation.
A group of people I openly fantasize about running over with my car. I'm sorry.
No one likes these people. I'm surprised it makes money because it
infuriates
horrible.
Me that it's productive, that's the best use of their time is standing out there trying to get me to sign something or give them my email address. I don't believe it's the best use of their time. They must just be like volunteer position interns or something. They don't have any work for them to do.
No, I almost did this when I was in college for a college job for the ACLU. But this was back when they were a little less crazy and I was a little – my views were a little different too.
Yeah.
A salary, you know, an hourly wage to do it. I'm just surprised it makes money for the organization given how much contempt everyone has for them.
It's the same. They're parked right outside our office building, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be many of the same people who pass that way
every day. Yeah.
Like it's the people going to their jobs. Like it's not.
Yeah.
It doesn't downtown Manhattan on Broadway or something like. You know, the whole of all of America, all of the world crossing your path.
Right.
Here, it just doesn't seem.
And I can also see, like, if you're an actual panhandler that, like, people, you know, might give you a dollar every once in a while, and that actually adds up over time, right? But the idea that, like, someone is going to stop on the street and sign up for, like, a monthly donation to Amnesty International is crazy to me. But this is all beside the point. We don't like these people.
No.
But it's beside the point because I want to bring this up for spring weather because there was an 80-degree day that we had. It was wonderful. And the next day it was like 40 degrees. And I passed by these Nature Conservancy people asking for money. And they're like, do you want to stop global warming? I'm like, no, I want to accelerate it.
Make it more intensely
warm. Bring back
warm.
Yesterday. That's what I'm trying
for
to do
sure.
here. Yeah.
Every time there's any unseasonable cold whatsoever, I love to go, well... So much for that global warming canard, huh? It is kind of funny how the claim shifted from there will be global warming to
the weather will
be more unpredictable. They're like, let's call it climate change. There will be it will be different today than it was yesterday. The claim just gets weaker and weaker and weaker. Obviously, I do accept that human activity contributes to the changing of the climate. The apocalyptic demands about how the entire Earth will be just a ball of fire by, 2019 or whatever didn't quite pan out.
Yeah.
A little bit like the population arguments, but...
Right. Oh, yeah. Should we talk about...
Oh, yeah. We didn't talk about him last week. Ehrlich.
Paul Ehrlich. What was his official discipline? Demographer?
He's a scientist. Environmental scientist. He passed away 2 weeks ago.
Took his own advice and died.
Died of old age and, you know, never liked to wish death on anyone. But a very evil figure in terms of the output. He had a real impact. Published this book, 1968, I believe, The Population Bomb,
yes,
about how global overpopulation was going to lead to depletion of resources and mass starvation.
Yes.
And he picked he made specific, verifiable claims about, he said, Britain would cease to exist because it'd be so overpopulated. He said India, widespread starvation he gave a date and a year. Mm-hmm. He famously bet an economist of our thinking that the price of
Julian Simon,
right, the price of certain commodities would go up. They didn't. He lost that one. He was wrong. He was unbelievably wrong from beginning to end on all of these predictions, because what he didn't anticipate is that humans are a resource. And human productivity is a resource. You have more people. You have more people thinking through problems in innovative ways. The India problem specifically solved by the Green Revolution. Farming innovations made it possible for fewer people to do farm labor and feed many, many times as many people, despite mm-hmm. the population going up.
Mm-hmm.
So we have today Earth has more people than ever before, and there are fewer people. A smaller proportion of them starve than ever before.
Yeah.
It's just... His thesis was exactly wrong.
Right.
It was completely wrong in every way. But it wasn't just some guy. This was a highly
influential
book.
Yeah.
Convinced people. I mean, he endorsed China-style one-kid policies.
Yeah. It's forced sterilizations.
He advocated increasingly repressive measures to stop people from having large families. Mm-hmm. And by large families, I mean like more than one or two.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't really – his policies weren't implemented in the U.S., but he contributed to a cultural – there were clubs. Like people wanted to – people felt the shame of having a large family. He'd raised the stigma of doing that.
Yes. And he wanted
– all for no reason.
He wanted more of that, right? He wanted more Captain Planet saying it's bad if you have more yes. children, things like that.
Yes.
I would disagree that he didn't necessarily influence policy in the United States, not in explicit population control, which, you know, in a democracy you generally don't do.
Right.
Right? But he was very influential as part of this slow growth environmentalism of the 70s and, mm-hmm. and onward, where the way that you protect the climate is by just not – and the environment is just by building nothing ever and consuming less, right?
Degrowth.
Yes, degrowth, right? We're going to shrink the cities down into little compact nodes. We're going to have, you know, the way you help the environment is by, you know, reusing your soup cans and that kind of environmentalism, right? That's the kind of environmentalism we grew up with, right?
Yes.
And it's the kind of environmentalism that led to a massive plunge in housing production in, you know, states that adopted these urban growth policies.
It's Silent Spring.
Like.
It's
yes.
him. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. these kinds of 60s, 70s environmental types.
Yeah.
And that we grew up in their world.
Yeah. And
world
the law.
Obsessed with competition for diminishing resources.
Yes. Right. I still remember in like textbooks I had in high school where they would like it would had explicitly on one biology textbook. I remember it was like, here is the fair share of human resources that each human should be allowed to consume, which is like a tiny like $5,000 a year or something. Right?
I remember like rapid population growth being like a term, you know, in your social studies book mm-hmm. or whatever, being a, you know, one of the five terms you have to learn about this week, you know, mm-hmm. mercantilism, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah, from being rapid population growth. And that,
right.
that being just, that's a negative thing.
Right.
Because this was still downstream of Ehrlich's ideas.
Right.
And it's just him.
Mm-hmm.
He was the inventor of this entire philosophy that was provably wrong within a few years of him writing that book.
Yep.
But he went to his grave convinced he was right and saying he only wished he had been even more apocalyptic in tone, unrepentant.
Crazy. Yeah. Given the like number of like forced abortions and everything
yes.
else that resulted from
yes.
this guy's policies. That's
yeah.
All right. Well, we know where he is now.
No, it's an evil philosophy, an anti-human being. Human beings, life is precious and beautiful and should be encouraged. and is a good unto itself.
Yeah, that's not what you're saying before we started taping. it's actually remarkable too because
this planet is for people.
Planet is for people. Yes. We have dominion over the animals.
Yes.
And,
yes.
It is remarkable.
They exist because they please us. They must pleasure us.
The platypus was created, and it was good.
That sloth? Sloth videos?
Oh, boy. Yeah. We watched a few sloth videos before taping today, so yeah. You can forgive us.
The sloth is a great animal.
It's hilarious looking.
It's a good animal.
It looks like it's like all the positive qualities were sucked out of a human stoner and put into an animal without any of the negative qualities.
Animals are good.
A sloth will never tell you a long meandering story about how they got high one time, but...
I like going to the zoo.
Oh, I love the zoo.
Looking at the animals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, animals are interesting and good. Mm-hmm. But they're good because they provide value to us.
Yes, right.
This is very different.
Yeah.
They don't have souls or a...
No, in fact, yeah. Normal, like, why do we find animal cruelty so repulsive? I think mostly it's because
to find it repulsive.
Yeah, but mostly I think it's because it says something gross about the person doing it, right?
Yes.
There is an interesting utilitarian argument about, well, if something can feel pain, then causing pain in of itself is bad. It's an interesting argument. It leads you to some weird places. Though the one other thing I want to say about Paul Ehrlich is, if anything, like, we've gone to the other side of apocalypticism about population now. Now everyone is freaking out about low
not
birth
having
rates
enough kids.
And not enough children. And I have some concern about this too, but I think this is all a good reminder of just like the apocalyptic wave of the future that you assume is some inevitable law of history is always going to be overplayed and overstated, right?
For sure.
And it's going to change in 20 or 30 years.
For sure.
Right. Yeah. Is there, of the like big apocalyptic scenarios, which one do you think is the most realistic that you wake up in the middle of the night
plague.
And worry about? Plague?
Plague. Mm. Easy. Plague.
Why do you say that?
COVID. That thing was a little bit more lethal. Everybody, that's what I mean. There are past examples in human history. We look to things that will happen.
Yeah.
You should look back to things that did happen.
Yeah.
And what did happen is that periodically there was a catastrophic disease that the people of the time could do absolutely nothing about that killed a large percentage of the world, right? The Black Plague in Europe, the story of the discovery of America is the spread of disease and everyone dying.
Yeah.
That does worry me.
So
what would we do? I mean—
Right. I don't worry.
Stop experimenting on viruses, please.
Well, okay. So that actually does massively
no,
worry me.
No, that is my worry.
Because a natural originating plague will have these built-in limits,
sure.
Right? If it's super transmissible, it almost by definition can't be incredibly lethal because then everyone would die too early. And so that
but
would
if
slow
we,
the
if
spread.
We engineer it to be that way.
If we engineer
Dr.
a plague.
Fauci gets his way.
Yeah. If they
there'll be no one left alive.
Yeah. It might stop disease, right? We have to invent the virus it's a national treasure logic. We have
Quite
to invent
literally.
The virus to stop the virus.
That's what I worry about.
I think that's completely reasonable. Yeah, because it's one of those things where it's like the humans are like actively trying to bring about doomsday.
Yes.
The other one, this is not super in vogue these days, but like I think like nuclear war actually.
You're a nuclear war guy.
These weapon systems exist. Like, you read. I finished listening to a book called Sleepwalkers about the beginning of the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And the thesis of that book is basically that like. Everyone, like all the participants involved, very few of them actively wanted the war. It was just a continuous series of like, well, if we don't fight this, we'll be in an even worse position.
Right.
But we're bemoaning the fact that this war is coming. Like the story you normally hear about the First World War is everyone's itching for a fight, national
right.
glory, empire, whatever else. By and large, everyone is really glum about and surprised that things are careening towards this cataclysmic conflict, right? This is the perspective of the Sleepwalkers book.
Interesting.
I know this; it's a controversial thesis. This is one of the like many debate, like most debated topics in history. Is like why did World War I break out? But if that's the case for a conventional war, a planet-ending apocalypse that could happen in 10 minutes, of course,
there would have to be a whole lot of nukes flying
that's
to have extinction-level type thing happen. right?
Well, so I guess this would be the worry about modern society is, and nuclear war specifically. So firstly, it's like, how many nukes do you need to have like cataclysmic weather events across the world, right?
Right.
And if it's enough to cause giant winters and then all the crops fail, then you have maybe mass death, if not extinction death events. The other worry, and this actually applies to plague as well, is we're just so specialized that, you know, it makes a certain percentage of the population, like, you know, 10% of the population dying is actually much more significant because, you know, everyone is so specialized in their economic role that economic production is easier to fall apart,
well,
right?
Well, sure.
So if, when everyone in the Black Death, they say, you know, a third of Europe's population died, right? But if a third of Europe's population is subsistence farmers, then it's like, I don't want to be callous, but
right.
Like,
no, no, right. Right. There are arguments that it actually improved the standard of living in Europe because...
Right, because wages went up because there was less labor, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I would have to think
they
about
hadn't figured out
that.
How to do society correct yet anyway.
Right.
it would hurt us worse.
It would.
If it was the same percentage of...
Right. And so like one thing people bring up is like... you know, what if there's no one to run the nuclear plants and then those all melt down, right?
Right.
And
this is part of the stand.
Is it?
They, you know, they form the virus kills, 99.something% of everybody. And so that leaves like a couple million people still alive.
Yeah.
And they're forming these two communities in America that are rival communities, and the one led by the bad people are in Vegas, and they're like,
makes sense.
One of their missions is they send some guy to go get the nukes, go to the nuclear silos and get us some nukes, which is part of the Deus Ex Machina ending for that.
Interesting. It has like a supernatural ending though.
Yeah, the hand of God comes down and detonates the nuke on Las Vegas to kill all
spoilers.
The bad guys.
I
wish it was not that dumb, but it is. It's a great book. For the first, the plague part is great because you get to know so many characters who just all die.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you see it happening before they see it. Like, man, everybody's really sick. What is going on? The breakdown of society part. Mm-hmm. And then with so many people dead and the utter breakdown of society. And then the survivors having to, like, meet up with each other and just having, like, adventures on the road that are where... kind of like Walking Dead, where like, somebody needs to have their appendix taken out. This is now a huge, huge problem. Or we have to cross through this area where there's highwaymen who are going to try to rape our women because society's broken down. That stuff's all really interesting. And then the beginning of what their society would look like and then it goes off the rails.
Yeah, see, I've never read the book for this very reason.
Yeah.
Because this is every...
That's like 70% of the book. It's good up until... that part.
Then I'd be upset.
Yeah.
Here's my heterodox view on apocalypses.
Yeah.
Like this. I feel like the roving warring bands thing actually wouldn't happen because there would be because society is rich enough right now that there would be endless resources to pillage, right? There's so much embedded, you know, calories and energy already stored out there. You could just go and have as much as you want. And so then the premium would be on cooperation and sociability, because then that would allow you to...
The premium would be on a couple real technical skills, like doctors, right? Doctors would be the most important.
Maybe not, though, because, like, you know, as a doctor with only so limited resources to... I mean, maybe I guess there would be like leftover medication.
There'll be leftover medication.
I think like mechanics and engineers, right? Horticulturists, haberdashers, beekeepers.
There would be a lot of food. I mean, there would be there'd be cans of food.
You would be in an
fresh
apocalypse.
Fresh food would spoil.
Let me explain what you'd be doing in an apocalypse, Robbie. You'd be sitting on like 2,000 cans of tuna and no one to play cards with. And so the next person that comes along, you wouldn't be like, are they from tribe, you know, the green tribe?
Bring me the boy.
No, you'd be like, please come in. Yeah. I think
maybe,
so.
Maybe? I don't know.
Well, we're going to find out.
I mean, that's not what happens in every post-apocalypse, but...
But that's because we want the apocalypse. In some ways, you know, I think this is maybe what motivated Paul Ehrlich in a way. Some of us, we desire the apocalypse, you know.
Mm.
That urge for self-destruction becomes an urge for species-wide destruction.
In DC, no one would even go outside. You know, you'd be out there trying to, you know, get together a post-apocalyptic gang, and they'd be like, "Excuse me, only two people to a gathering." Right. Yeah, you'd have Mega Karen out there.
Right. Yeah, just have to double mask during your rape gang.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to live through the post-apocalypse at all. I'm not gonna lie. Well, electronics would go down.
Yeah.
In the plague scenario, right? Because people have to be administering
data the centers systems, and so they'll
all,
utilities.
It'll all crash. Yeah. The power will all go out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As soon as society collapses, and that will be no fun.
Yeah.
And then you'll have to have the survivors will have to have among them an electrician to do the. I wouldn't even know the beginning of how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go to whatever the data center is, or.
Let's just say, yeah, it's another great illustration of, like, division of labor. Because, like, even if you had the person who knows how to run the utilities, would it even make sense, you know, to operate that? Instead, yeah. You know, it's like, actually, your labor, we can't sustain this level of specialization. You should just go, you know, farm.
Yeah, I mean, right? We're going to be boiling water immediately.
We're going to be boiling water.
Because the running water is going to stop working. Right. We have to boil water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's physical labor.
Yeah.
That's going to suck.
Not fun.
That's going to suck.
Not fun. Yeah.
For those of us who make our living sitting around having takes.
No, but I think
would
there'll
you
be
like a...
I think there'll be a premium on that because people are so bored right now.
We'll be like troubadours.
Yes, exactly.
We'll wander Bards. From post-apocalyptic settlement to settlement.
Being like, that's based. That's woke.
Doing our Tucker Carlson impression. Wow, that's so interesting. No one's ever said that before. Yeah. They don't even want you to hear it.
You're saying
they never talk about it.
Yeah, you never hear journalists saying that you don't have to boil the water.
You should boil the water, especially if it's out of the Potomac.
Oh,
the
Anacostia. Right, yeah, given the sewage.
Yeah, even
spill.
Even RFK Jr. would be boiling that water.
He wouldn't even get in that water wearing his jeans. Yeah.
Well, I think we got to leave it there. A little shorter show today because I got to do some other media hits. But
very well.
It's been fun. I had other. We'll save gym etiquette for next week.
Oh man! Oh, well, you talk about boiling water.
I got 2 minutes. What
okay.
happened to you?
Tell me on a scale of 1 to 10 how disgusting you think this is. I was in the locker room changing.
Disgusting.
And there was, thank you. And there was someone on the bench next to me eating a sweet greens salad in
that
the gym locker
is
room.
Is absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, out of 10, what'd you
That's
say there?
10.
Yep.
10.
Okay.
Salad in a gym
locker room.
Locker room.
My naked self is 5 feet away from your food. You
Although
don't
want
you
that. Hold up a leaf to block you, like right. like little Roman art.
Yeah, except it's dripping, you know, olive oil and the leaf.
Did he have it door dashed to the locker room?
I don't think it was
that would be
I don't think it was that perverse.
I don't want DoorDash people everywhere, like in buildings. It's getting to be a little too much. Go get your own salad. You know what? Make your own salad. It's very easy to make. You can make a salad.
That level of specialization we can still pull
in the post-apocalypse. We can make our own salads. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Let's leave it there.
See you later.